All right. Okay, folks, welcome to the Thesis Theater event. My name is Brenton Dickinson. I'm one of the profs at Signum University, and I teach more in the literature side of things, and I work as a preceptor as well. I'm very happy, very pleased to be hosting this Thesis Theater. I have attended them, this is my second student as a thesis student to come through this process. It's not an easy process, generally I think the students are a little terrified at Thesis Theater, but for those of us who are supervising, this is kind of the fun bit, and we get to kind of enjoy the work that we kind of watched as it went through this 8 month or year long type process of narrowing down ideas and bringing them into some kind of a form. So I'm gonna let Rob talk about his own. He's gonna set up the concept here in a sec, but I wanted to just introduce him a little bit. Rob is from Canada.
Yeah.
He got a BED and a Bachelor in Science from University of Regina, and that's a real place for non-Canadians. And now, I suppose, has his MA at Signum University. Rob teaches science at Churchbridge, in Churchbridge, Saskatchewan, I think with junior high students mostly, is that right?
Senior science. Yeah.
And he lives with his wife Jenny and their two kids. Aside from teaching and his scholarly endeavors at Signum, Rob can be found designing a new game for his game company, Birdlike Games, which I think we've actually linked, but you can also check that out through the Facebook site there, Birdlike Games. He likes to play new instruments and loves games, a cappella.
You bet.
I was hoping for the bow tie a little.
I thought I would actually sing.
There we go. Hiking, ultimate frisbee, slacklining, which I have.
Tightrope walking between two trees. You need to try it.
We have tried it. It's like you take a giant seatbelt and try and walk it. dance and chess, which he sometimes does all those together. So I'm going to hand this over to Rob. Rob's going to set up the concept. We're going to work through some ideas. And then in about 20 minutes to half an hour, it'll start opening up for questions. And then the last third of it will be more of a Q&A. So do get some good questions. We've kind of got it all scripted out here, but we would love to hear what your curiosity is, because I'm pretty sure the base idea of Rob's concept is not new to most of the people that are logging in right now. Mm-hmm. And so really the question is what has Rob kind of brought to this, and what is it, what's really important to both of us, and Rob's really been driving this, you know, what is it that that you can walk away with as somebody who's attending here today? So go ahead and take it from here, Rob.
Yeah, sure. Thanks, Brenton. First of all, I just want to thank everyone for coming and give you welcome. And for those of you who will view this after the fact as a recording, welcome. So my thesis topic is about the intersection between Tolkien's work and human creativity. And I examine in particular the effect of Tolkien's creative vision on my own artistic work. My paper, if you've read the abstract, it's entitled J.R.R. Tolkien's Subcreative Vision, Exploring the Capacity and Applicability in Tolkien's Concept of Subcreation. My thesis argues that Tolkien's concept of subcreation is a product of his expanse vision of the nature and significance of human creativity, and an all-inclusive invitation to apply his vision to our own creative work, whatever the form of that creative work. Many of us have come to Tolkien's work and found a creative voice that has been in our hearts perhaps all along. But prior to Tolkien was perhaps lost, roaming, or stunted by the forms or structures we've been given until it was set free or energized by Tolkien. Throughout my talk, I want to invite you to consider in what ways Tolkien's approach to creativity has affected your own artistic work. And hopefully near the end of this talk, like Brenton shared, your responses can generate some further conversation about the impact of Tolkien's subcreative vision. So think on this. How has Token influenced your own creative expression? And again, regardless of the creative form, so not just writing, perhaps for some it will be in the visual or performing arts, for others research, in my case it's in game design and the very writing of my thesis. How has Token impacted your creative work? How has he influenced your vocation as an artist? So type those questions away, and hopefully throughout the talk we can generate some dialogue from them.
Yeah, I think you can already see that we're trying to turn this upside down a little bit. Normally we'd now go to like, what was your interest in the topic? But I mean, we know what the interest is with subcreation, right? And so what we thought that right from the top, we'd flip that around and actually have Rob sort of live out his interest a little bit for us in this limited media of the GoToWebinar online world design here that we have here. You may, if you have your own copy of Leaf and Tree, you may want to turn to it. Rob's going to be looking at the Mythopoeia poem, of course, the classic expression of Token's subcreative vision, or the one of the classic ones. And so if you have your copy, he's going to start, and I think you're actually going to recite, is that right, from the fifth stanza of the poem?
Yeah.
Is that right, Rob? Yeah, okay. So go ahead, if you have that open or you have it digitally, then open that up and you can follow along. And I'll Rob, why don't you go ahead and recite that for sure. Us?
So I'll quote from it starts the phrase, "The heart of man is not compound of lies." The heart of man is not compound of lies, but draws some wisdom from the only wise and still recalls him. Though now long estranged, man is not wholly lost nor wholly changed. Disgraced he may be, yet is not dethroned, and keeps the regs of lordship once he owned. His world dominion by creative act, not his to worship the great artifact, man sub-creator, the refracted light, through whom is splintered from a single white to many hues and endlessly combined in living shapes that move from mind to mind. Though all the crannies of the world we filled with elves and goblins, though we dared to build gods and their houses out of dark and light and sowed the seed of dragons, 'twas our right, used or misused, the right has not decayed. We make still by the law in which we're made.
Yeah, thank you, Rob. Actually, it was this sort of moment that I think connected us at first, right? I think you had you recited this at one of the myth moots or something, or at a myth con?
I had memorized the poem because of its impact on my own creative expression, and so yeah, I got a chance to deliver it by surprise, the whole poem. Yeah.
Oh, yeah, yeah. And then I think you shared that with me during one of our class sessions a couple of years ago. And so the thesis developed out of that. Well, I think you've shown us, I think we can get from the vocal tone sort of where your interest is. What's kind of, tell us about how you come then to the project. What kind of got your mind buzzing, you know, emotionally and then intellectually?
Yeah. Well, I was interested in subcreation because it had become for me such a vivid and wide-ranging idea of Token, such a big idea. Ever since I came across Token's essay on fairy stories, where he described the term, I knew I was dealing with something really big. Another different stream is just my own love for making things. I was interested in Token's idea of subcreation because probably for the last 20 or so years, I've been designing games. Long before I came across Token's work or knew anything about subcreation. And I felt I could really identify with Token in a little way. Token seemed for me kind of this creative hero, a massive creative hero, but I loved his creative genius in his stories, and then When I came across, so I'd read The Hobbit, The Lord of the Rings. When I came across The Silmarillion for the first time and I saw this vast mythology that he had made, I was blown away really by the capacity of his world building, its degree and its depth. Mm. So that was another big, big connection point. And then finally it was, yeah, coming across the poem. And the poem I name is the fundamental kind of celebration of my interest in Tolkien. It was very intuitive. I didn't fully know why I loved this poem so much. And a big part of my thesis was wanting to dive into that. Why I saw a vast vision of subcreation in the poem, and actually thought it was bigger what I saw in it than Tolkien's discussion of subcreation in On Fairy Stories, which is the kind of the seminal text usually we'd say as scholars on his idea. So
yeah, but okay, so there's, it's going to be clear to those peeking in, and I hope there are students that have their thesis coming up that are either watching this on video or attending it live now, because it's going to be clear by the end why the process has been important, right, Rob? You know, so, but I don't know that we need to tell all that just yet, but the that'll come out by the end. It'll be clear why that all links together. but so on day one of a thesis supervision meeting, right, what's the first question that I would ask you, Rob? What would be the first thing that I would want to know? What is
my research question?
What is your research question, right? And we all know that it adapts and changes, and occasionally the research question jumps off the page and attacks the researcher in fatal ways. But that's the key. What was your research question coming into this project?
I didn't have one. That's weird. No, I knew where my interests lay, you know, but they kept circling around the areas of subcreation, the significance of the poem Mythopoeia, but I was dancing in so many places. I really had a hard time narrowing those interests. So by the time that I had come at the end of my thesis research semester submitting my prospectus, where I have to identify my research question, it was at that time, in what ways does Tolkien's theory of subcreation interrelate with performance theory? And if you read my thesis, you might see some flavors of where that, but you know it's not there, and that's because over the course of the writing process and months into it, really, is when those fundamental questions, those driving questions, really emerged. And so what I eventually arrived at were three driving questions, which I used to organize my paper, and they're connected questions. What is it about Tolkien's concept of subcreation that gives rise to the expansive array of possible meanings? What makes subcreation so capacious? Moreover, what are its uses and applications today?
Yeah.
So you see in my title, exploring the capacity and applicability of subcreation, that kind of organized my approach to the study.
Mm. Now there's lots of work done on subcreation as a concept. I think it's probably the one that captures many of our imaginations just so quickly. What were the three, you didn't spend a lot of time in your thesis going over the core work. I guess there's a foundational mm-hmm. part. What are the three basic texts that are typically used that Tolkien uses just quickly to talk about subcreation? Where can readers go? Or actually,
I was going to pose that to the audience a little bit, see what they say, but maybe they've read my abstract.
Yeah, if they've read your abstract, it's actually listed. just note there, but first, give me. We want everybody to be involved. What's a How would you describe the idea of subcreation to somebody at a coffee shop in line while you're waiting for your order? How would you just say, what's your thesis on? It's on subcreation. What is subcreation? Go. Just tell me that. Yeah. Just quickly. Yeah.
And you're asking the audience.
I'm asking you, actually. Oh, okay. You
know, okay.
5 minutes later. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, the ready definition that you might read in On Fairy Stories, the, the making of a secondary world that other minds can enter. And then Tolkien adds to that, that concept of building an internally consistent world that would be believable and credible to those that enter that. And that, if you look for, if you do a Google definition, or if you go to the OED, Oxford English Dictionary, that's what it'll point to, that On Fairy Stories meaning of subcreation.
And what does the Mythopoeia poem add for you? Like what layer level does it add? Because it doesn't say it in at all the same kind of language. What sort of images or phrases pop out for you?
Yeah, so that part I quoted, man subcreator, the refracted light. Subcreator, it only appears once in the poem. It's the first time Tolkien ever used the word, because the poem historically came first. But there it's an identity, it's a name. It's a modifier that Tolkien uses to describe humanity, you know, humankind. We are sub-creators. And later on end of the stanza, we make still by the law in which we're made. You know, and there's much more. He uses the little maker as another way of exploring his idea, and that's in the poem. But just subcreator appears once, and part of my project was looking at the actual word and where it appeared across the Tolkien text.
And you looked at some of the scholarship as well. Let me just quote that line. You know it, but the little maker has with maker's art, right? Mm-hmm. So that the echoing of capital M maker and little maker. And then there's a sort of mini kingship, I think, right, throughout the poem, right? And
I just want to quote that portion now.
you could.
I will not treat your dusty path in flat, denoting this and that by this and that. Your world immutable, wherein no part the little maker has with maker's art. I bow not yet before the iron crown, nor cast my own small golden scepter down.
We spent a lot of time talking, going through the poem together, and and certainly the worldview challenge is clear there. But you kept coming back to the artistic space, right? Mm-hmm. The space of the artist, rather than thinking of this as a theologian or thinking of this as a literary critic primarily, although you're doing literary criticism. You kept coming back to kind of where this is. What gap did you see in the end that you ended up speaking to? Because I think we would all know some of the people that have talked about subcreation, but what does the gap where you address the little maker, that subcreative vision, in your own particular way in this project?
Coming from that On Fairy Stories definition again, upon reading On Fairy Stories, there's such an emphasis on literary subcreation. Subcreation within the context of literary worlds. Subcreation is writing, and it's usually associated with fantasy literature. Now, I had intuitively, when I came across subcreation, been applying it to my game design work, and that's totally different. And so then that asks the question, is that even warranted? You know, to go beyond the literary frame. And I wanted to look at where did this come from? Because I had read all of Tolkien's work, and why was I making this intuitive jump? And I hope that by writing my paper, more people would realize, like I did, that subcreation is not limited to writers of fantasy, but to all people, all the little makers of J.R.R. Tolkien's sub-creative, and I use the word vision.
And I think so. And you had a couple, a number of minor, but a couple major conversation partners. Who were they with you in this journey?
There was Verlin Flieger, and much of her work, but I would say primarily Splintered Light.
Yeah.
Logos and language in Tolkien's world.
Is referenced. That's referenced in the part that you recited at the top, right? That her book resonates out of that entire section that you were quoting from. Sorry, go ahead. Yeah.
Yeah. So I'll mention the other, and then we can decide how to delve into either. But another major one, and you'll see its influence throughout my work, is Mark J.P. Wolfe. He wrote Building Imaginary Worlds, The Theory and History of Subcreation. That was a very important piece.
Yeah. And so tell me I keep misquoting Mark Wolfe on this point, right? So remember, I keep calling him multimodal, but what's the actual word that he uses? So you came with this instinct. You read this subcreative thing. You applied it to your life as designer.
Mm-hmm.
Even though Tolkien in his essay talks about literature, in particular world building literature, right? So fantasy and fairy tale. Mm-hmm. But you just automatically drew it into your own life, right? Mm-hmm. So what kind of language did Mark Wolfe give you? Because he actually took your project before he knew you, or you know, and academicized it, right? So what kind of language did he use that gives you that?
Yeah, so Brenton used the word multimodal.
Which is not the right word. Or is it
fine? He uses the word transmedial.
Yeah.
And what he's doing in his work is extending Tolkien's concept of subcreation. However, I see it in Tolkien's own exploration, but Wolfe is extending it to transmedial, so that's across media. So let me just find that quote that I use. Transmedial modes of storytelling, including literature, comics, film, radio, television, board games, video games, the internet, and more. So he's taking it outside of that literary frame as well. I had been doing that before I knew about Wolfe's yeah. work, but he gave me permission to speak out about, and he gave me a language that to use that, you know, I could really identify with. You know, that he was speaking my language, telling the story of that I could really identify in my own story of subcreation through game design.
And I think I'm going to use this moment to do something incredibly inappropriate. And actually, Mark Wolfe actually read your thesis in the end. And here are some of the comments that he said about this. Because I think this illustrates a point that we're going to get to. So he talks about having read a lot of projects, and we do as academics, we come across a lot, and most of it's pretty good. Rub's thesis is one of the most enjoyable such things that I have read in a while. The thesis is well written, well structured, it moves along at a good rate, and contains what my own work has been rightfully accused of containing: enthusiasm. And so I thought that was he goes on to give his the normal assessment, but I thought that was a good point. And I mean, what were some of the discoveries that you made? Because I think one of them is the thesis itself, right? What were some of the discoveries that you made along the way? So I'm really setting up for the question of capacity that you've already addressed, but in your own, I'm interested in your work as a thesis writer at this stage. Mm-hmm. What for you was that like? And how did the idea of subcreation inform that?
Yeah. How I had initially laid out my thesis kind of was to go through on fairy stories, to go through by Nagel, and to go through Mythopoeia.
Yes.
Because those were recognized subcreation texts by other scholars and certainly by me as well. And then also to look at that alongside Tolkien's published letters. And so to give an example of a real discovery moment was that letter Tolkien drafted to Peter Hastings, a Catholic correspondent. And if you read my abstract, you'd see a really central, a remarkable statement that Tolkien makes. It's not actually this statement that I'm about to talk about, but I should read it because it's very powerful and just shows, like, why is this important in Tolkien to look at this? Well, he writes to Peter Hastings, the whole matter of my myth from beginning to end is mainly concerned with the relation of creation to making and subcreation, and subsidiarily with the related matter of mortality. It must be clear that references to these things are not casual, but fundamental. Well, Peter Hastings, the letter to Peter Hastings, well, it was a draft. It never got to Mr. Hastings, but got to us. it has a lot there. It's written in 1954. It's after these other expressions of subcreation. And something that stood out was actually just this little moment where Tolkien talks about Leif by Nagel. And I don't have the statement right here. I should find it really. But Tolkien says that what he's doing in his in Leif by Nagel is different than what he's doing in his myth. And that he is looking at subcreation as a form of criticism of art. And he explores in the story of Leif by Nagel how that is drawn up into creation. Now, that phrase, criticism of art, looking at subcreation as criticism of art, and how Tolkien was doing something different with subcreation, well, all of a sudden, I was like, oh, this is wonderful, because Tolkien is trying to extend the meanings of his own concept. And if you can remember the story, if you're familiar with it, you can remember Leif by Nagel's a painter. He has this vast vision of a tree, and he's trying to paint it, and he's always detailing these leaves over and over and over again, and he never finishes it, and it's never complete on one side of the journey anyway. And then he encounters two voices, and they're evaluating Nagel's work. And Tolkien is, he's pressing into that idea of subcreation as art criticism. Nagel is being evaluated. He's being measured for his subcreation, and he's not a writer. He's a painter. We've got Parrish, who's a gardener, and Tolkien is expanding definitions of subcreation to be beyond just literature. People could approach the Leif by Nagel story as an autobiographical kind of story, but here we get this letter where Tolkien's addressing, just as one example, subcreation as something else, as art criticism. And that's really kind of what I was doing. I was applying subcreation to my own art. So it could be a framework that the artist can use. And I certainly had been using it in game time.
Yeah, no, that's right. I think, you make the point in your thesis, like even just the fact that Nagel is a painter rather than a writer, should start to invite us to press the question of capacity for this, and that it's sort of an allegorical cipher of life. I mean, aren't they kind of criticizing his life as well as his art, right? They're actually looking at his journey as a whole. So I think that works. So what did you? So you took that, and I think you added Aulë as well, right? So you actually look at that the
one, story of Aulë, yeah,
the as a subcreation story in the text, setting that up. You turn where, like, you know, so you go through, you set up the question of what subcreation is, what the vision is, the three classic texts, you turn to Aulë, and then you go where from there?
What did I do after Aulë? My analysis?
Yeah.
I went to myself.
You went to yourself. Yeah. Do you want to, this is going to be weird for people because, or it's going to be weird for some people because I think the natural thing, I think we started with the question of, well, now that you've got a framework, where in Tolkien's life or text could we turn, right? That was sort of, that was our natural go-to. That was kind of what you were thinking. But in the end, you turn to your own life as evidence. What's the rationale for that? What are you doing with that kind of analysis?
Yeah, so it's autoethnography. And autoethnography is looking at my life as the text. And so auto-self and ethnography, the culture. So myself as the culture. And it's maybe a new wave of studies that need to happen with respect to Tolkien. And part of the reason why I wanted to pose that question to the audience about how has Tolkien's creativity affected your own? Mm-hmm. Because many of us can identify with that aspect. And so I wanted to look at my own work as a case study of a designer, a sub-creator, a little maker, and how I was impacted by Tolkien's sub-creative vision. Now, that's part of applicability. You know, this isn't a dry text to me at all, Tolkien's work. It energized my work. Mm-hmm. When I came across Tolkien's concept, it, in some ways, I would say, produced some of my work. Like it engendered it. It certainly inspired, but I don't know what my work would have looked like had I not come across such a vivid idea as Tolkien's.
But isn't, and you'll understand what I'm doing here, so don't be angry with me later. But like you make these games, right? Basically card-based games. Like they're pretty big rage right now, and you've made a couple of these. Aren't you just whipping some images into a kind of form? It'd just take a few hours to make a game, wouldn't it?
Yeah, just like maybe 10, you know? No.
Tell us about that process. Yeah. Then so you're coming at game design as a little maker. Mm-hmm. So tell us a little bit about, you can't obviously go too deep into it. And you're pretty brief even in the thesis, you're restrained, but tell us about that.
Yeah, the time, just to give a little context. So the time I spent, I loved 8 years of a particular project. And I only mentioned one game, the biggest game that I've made. It's called Friend or Foe. It's a fantasy board and card game. But it was 8 years in the making, and I spent 3,000 to 4,000 hours. You know, I didn't count, so I wouldn't be surprised if it's more. I think I want to be accurate, so I think I'm going kind of on the low end. And there is an immediate link, really, with the definition of subcreation in On Fairy Stories, the making of an imaginary world. I was making a game world. Mm-hmm. And so it's in that imaginative space, but I'm using physical ways of trying to express that. And so cards, rule book, the board, but I went through so many different phases. So I really, in coming across Tolkien's work and his reflective work on his own, he talked about what he was trying to do when he talked about subcreation. He was thinking about his own creative work. Where was I going to go with that? I could identify with a maker's perspective because I had made probably 30 or more iterations of Friend or Foe, and Wolf talks about subcreation as process and product. It's the beauty of the word, actually, subcreation as a noun. There was the process of subcreation, all those iterations of game design mentally, but then in the product form. And so prototyping was one piece of it, but I kind of saw it from idea to finished, from concept to finished product, that 8-year process saw lots of different little making, kind of levels of little making. So there was prototyping, which was the cheaper end of the thing. That's where I'm using my printer. I'm using cardstock. Oh, when I found cardstock for the first time, like the thicker stuff, and Photoshop and the different things I could do with it, different ways to cut the paper medium and make as good as I could with my own tools, a beautiful prototype. Well, that was the first phase. But then the next phase would have been looking at trademarking, copywriting, or copyright. Why can't I think of the word? Patenting. And then, okay, I'm ready to try and put this into the real. I want to get digital artists, and I want to use a word I like to use in my thesis. Well, just a little bit, co-subcreate. So have some co-subcreative collaboration with digital artists who then helped shape my own concepts of my game in seeing pictures that they brought to my mind. Well, the next phase was establishing my company. I part of On Fairy Stories was the desire for excellence, and Tolkien expresses that. He wants successful expression of subcreation, and so the desire, the aspiration to achieve a realistic subcreation, a genuine one, to subcreate well, that's in On Fairy Stories, and that flavor I brought out in my work, my desire to make a good looking product in my game. And so I formed Birdlight Games, formulated my motto, which is imagination, creation, connection. I would have said imagination, sub-creation, connection, yeah, but people wouldn't know what I'm talking about.
That almost became your thesis outline at one point, didn't it?
Yeah. And then the final stage was manufacturing the game. And there were risks involved in taking it to these kinds of levels, but this desire kind of exploded when I really got into the poem, got into Tolkien's work some more.
So I think the question box is filling up with two kinds of things. One are really interesting questions, and two, people starting to share their stories of how they instinctively knew that the capacity was there for that subcreative vision. So, and I want to give some space to those, but because I know that there's going to be students and potential supervisors and potential Signum students or other college students that are going to see this, I do want to, you didn't just turn the question of subcreation to your years of work as a designer.
Mm.
Right. And there might have been some niggling in that process somewhere, right?
Yes.
In a thesis, you can't afford to niggle. There's no time. Mm. Like we move you through. So there was no perfectionism or any of that kind of stuff. You whipped off your papers at the master's level pretty easily. They came to you fairly quickly. What was this process like? Was this just another just big paper for you, or was this some other kind of process?
Mm-hmm. Good question. So,
you share in your thesis, and Rob, you can choose how much you want to share this right now,
because
it'll be in the Signum library, so they can read it if they.
Yeah, this is probably the most important part to me in looking back on my thesis. I'll just give some quick context. I'm a teacher, and I have a young family. And I didn't think that I could complete my thesis without taking some time. So I applied for a leave of absence from my teaching position, and that allowed me to, you know, I envisioned being at home a little bit more, but then being able to really focus and consider this my full-time job to complete my thesis. Now, just for some other context, I just recently completed this paper. It was a month ago, January 19th, when I submitted it. And I struggled so much with the whole process. I added a lot of, there was a lot of internal pressure because I took this time off. I had to get this baby done. Well, I did work full-time hours at this, and even more sometimes I would go into a library or a coffee shop and I have in mind the section that I wanted to address, where I wanted to dive in, that the scholars I was working alongside and reading, wanting to incorporate. And I would many times start with a paragraph that I had had from the previous day. And by the end of the day, everything was, I had blown that up. It was in all these different pieces, and I left with a product that I couldn't even see anymore. And this happened so much. I had incredible writer's block, and I was falling apart and not sleeping. It had gotten really bad. And so I finished January 19th. Well, only a month, early December, I was approaching Professor Higgins and inquiring about our incomplete policy. Time was not the issue, but I was either looking, could I find a bit more time? Because I'm in this writer's block and it doesn't matter how hard I work. I cannot produce content. And I struggled very deeply with it. Just to give you a story, like my wife, Jenny, I wouldn't have survived without her. Well, I had fallen apart probably about six times over a course of 2 or 3 months. And one time I remember I was just coming into the kitchen and I said, Jenny, hold me. I can't handle this. And I had to push through that that doubt and uncertainty with whether I could get this done. For most of it, I just postponed that question. I didn't think it was possible, actually. And was so fatigued, so tired by the whole process itself. So I'm sure you can ask more questions. You know this process intimately, Brenton. We had many conversations in the midst of all of this, he and I. Yeah.
But you did break through.
I did, yeah.
I'll give you a chance to catch your breath there by just saying, I think actually, when you applied subcreation to the critic art, the art of criticism, and to your own process as a researcher, I think that was, to me, that was the thing that tied the whole thing together. Was that, you know, it was probably a bunch of things that broke through, but from my perspective, one of them was you being able to say, yeah, actually this is not going well. This is actually part of the vocation. This is part of what it means to be a little maker.
Right.
And it doesn't, I mean, it didn't go perfectly for Aule either, but you know, you're not one of the valor. So there's some limits to yourself as well, but like, this is actually a pretty common experience. People should know, for researchers, we don't always have the luxury in an 8-month project for that, but it's something to be cognizant of. And so in what you've been saying tonight, so some of the things that you said, so literature, world building, right? Visual art by Tolkien himself, criticism first by Tolkien and then of your own kind of reality. And then this whole world game design where consistency is the whole thing, right? I mean, that's the, you know, if you, it doesn't matter how visually amazing it is or whatever, if there's not consistency, then there's nothing else, right? Can I actually read a couple of comments, because people have been kind of expanding. I hope I can actually do justice to this. And Timothy, I see your questions here, and I'd like to approach them as well. But let me just read a couple of these things. Kate says, I read that as Kate Niggle, but it's not Kate Niggle. I have been for most of my adult life an actor. Theater, like other performance arts, differs from other arts and be essentially a cooperative art form, right? Mm-hmm. And even if I were to do a one-woman show, which I had written myself, I'd still need the creative input of designers, a director, even a producer. Leaf by Niggle is one of my favorite works, and I love the point in the garden when Niggle realizes that he needs Parrish to finish his art. Mm-hmm. And the place is even eventually named Niggle's Parrish, right? Which is a super well done moment. I think Tolkien, the very private author, realized that his creation was also influenced by the creativity of others, and I think that's a really instinctively strong comment, Kate, too, that we see researchers of the last decade have been sort of correcting the image of Tolkien alone in his bedroom, typing out on a typewriter in his bed, frantic that he would never get it all done, and suffering that alone. I don't think that was the case. Certainly Christopher Tolkien's retirement highlights at least one of those partners, right? Let me just read another one here, if I've got this right. Lyndon says, I know that when I write poetry, when I draw or when I paint, the final product is never quite finished. There's always a change or an addition or a detraction. I think that's the word, yeah. And so there you have that idea of sub-creation, and then you have that idea that there's excellence in the maker's art, right? Mm-hmm. Lyndon actually has a little bit more, and if you'll indulge that here, and then we'll turn to some questions. While a product is put out there, the little maker is always wanting to change or evolve the work. Yeah, and so I guess that's it. And then and then we have some questions. Yeah, that's right, Facebook. Kate Niggle on Facebook, right? So we have some questions, but I'll just say Lynn's comments relating autoethnography and subcreation is brilliant and brave. I think it's also brave, Lynn. But Tolkien didn't have a word for it, but what is Leaf by Niggle if it's not autoethnography, if it's not turning his own life into the data, you know, and other things too. But yeah, so that's good. Well, that's good. Are you okay with some questions? We've gotten pretty about a third of the way through our outline. Can we?
Yeah.
I think we're going to have to trust people to read the paper. And I think we should go to the questions because
Can I read just one little portion that Kate just made me think of?
Yeah, Actually, I have one for you to read at the end, but you go ahead now and read.
Sure. It's just short. We need to get to questions. That'd be great. I'm just jumping into Owlet, even though I haven't said too much about him. Where I see Tolkien really exploring the dynamic relational aspects of subcreation. Anyway, Owlet's longing for creative collaboration closely echoes that notion in Tolkien's essay of the fundamental human desire for shared enrichment, partners in making, and delight. That comes from On Fairy Stories. For the supporting work of other minds and hands is a central theme in Tolkien that merits further study, and one which operates at the lofty heights of the participatory music of the Ainur in Tolkien's Ainulindale, his creation myth, even into the lowly grounds, and Kate saw it, of Niggle's Parrish at time's end. Yeah.
Yeah, good. Excellent. All right, let me see if I can do justice to some of these questions. Timothy also had a comment, by the way, about the consistency that exists between the Tolkien games, board games, RPGs, card games, and how they have a fidelity to the themes and atmosphere of Tolkien's world. This may be too big, but like, because they're not terribly narrative, right? So what is it that, so it's not the narrative that ties those things together exactly. There's an informed narrative or an emerging narrative, right? So what is it that, what can show fidelity in a game, or maybe what is it in building a game that's like building a world? Maybe if I can transform that question, just because Timothy admitted the question might be kind of big for this context.
Great question. Well, if we're looking at process of subcreation, that gets at some very unique things. Tolkien's own writing process in the writing of the Lord of the Rings. So where you'd maybe go to History of Middle Earth and to look at how Tolkien went through many iterations of exploring how to tell the story, but often not knowing at certain points who, like he met Faramir, you know, and then he had no concept of that character. And so subcreation, part of its process is this discovery, this freedom to allow our ideas to go where they need to go. And that's not true of some other kinds of creative processes, right? And so subcreation, I look in my thesis a little bit, my paper, of its connection to freedom. And letting the artistic voice speak out of the heart, you know, and not knowing necessarily where we're going to end up in that process. And so in making a game, there's a lot of links on process as well with that kind of discovery, that if you're open-handed with it, and that I see as intrinsic to the subcreation kind of mode of making. But he addressed some other things there, so I don't know if.
Yeah, and I wouldn't go too big. I mean, I was reading to my son Return of the King, and at one point the whole sentence was, it was October the 5th or something, right? And this is, you know, Tolkien kind of making sure that, like, the planetary and the weather and the geographical and the anniversary dates and, the like, all of this fits in some certain kind of way. I mean, I think a lot of that would be your game design, right? With making all the little pieces fit together so that the world that nobody even notices is consistent enough to allow the life of the thing itself to live. Is that fair? Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. A couple of other actually comments have come in here. Even though I think you're already answering this question indirectly, I'd like to put this forward. Singer-songwriter Steve Bell, I think you've heard of Steve Bell, had described his own view on how creation was an excess overflow of God's love. Should I keep reading, or can you anticipate this?
Do it, do it.
From an excess of God's love, just wanting to burst forward from the deep inside of God. Given that Tolkien was heavily informed from his faith, and that Christianity was for him the ultimate myth, which all other creations of myth spills forth. While Tolkien's own creativity bursts forward as the written word and has evolved over time, where do you see now your own expression of excess overflow of God, this little creation, to that of God's in terms of secondary world building via gaming? That's a big sentence. but first of all, you went on a pilgrimage in the middle of your thesis, didn't you?
What's that?
You went on a pilgrimage in the middle of your thesis, right? Or maybe minor. Did you go to see Steve Bell?
I did, yeah. Steve Bell and Malcolm Geis. I did it. Performed a joint concert with the Winnipeg Symphony Orchestra. Yeah,
that's right. Oh, wow. Yeah, that's right. I've seen a bit of that. Yeah, and so did you know that Steve Bell's idea of that the tumbling forth or the burning forth of God's love? Had you seen that, heard that before? Or?
Yeah, there's a lot I could say about different parts of that that comment.
Well, let me actually use another question that came in and says, what does it mean to apply the version of subcreation to one's own particular art? And so maybe I can combine those two questions, right? So, you know, like, you know, if I'm a dancer or a baker or a parent or a teacher or a, I don't know, tattoo artist, what is it? How do those things come together, that subcreative vision? How does that work out in the own particular art? The person, Tim says, is it a feeling or an inspiration, you know, or is it more tangible? Is it actually, does it change the way that we do it?
What I mentioned so far is excellence, but also discovery and freedom in the art. Not having that this is how the art has to look. And so letting it go places that maybe we didn't intend. And that can be broadly applied across many of those different kinds of vocations, I guess.
Yeah, I think the freedom one, that you should, it's okay to hang on that for a bit. I mean, think about, so you spent 3,000-5,000 hours on a game, you did another game, you did a master's degree, which as a science teacher probably isn't exactly the training path that they would have imagined you would take, right? Like, you know, a lot of us are pretty ridiculous, I think, that are attending here, that go to Signum, or that are working on writing and catching this sort of thing, or various arts, right? We need a kind of permission, don't we, to not be useful, to not produce in the way that our white picket fence North American or Euro American dreams command us to, right? Don't we need that freedom? Yeah.
Yeah, for sure. I would say, yeah, but to us, not ridiculous. To Tolkien, yeah. Not, right? I talk about freedom also in the sense of creativity for its own sake. Hmm. That making is valuable in its own right, intrinsically valuable. That is in his vision. So if you read my portion on the word vision, I apply that word, and I explain why I use that word. It has us see things differently. How Tolkien lets, we go to Tolkien to let our creativity breathe. The spacious nature of Tolkien's concept of subcreation, I say, is its very virtue, how vast his concept is. Its latitude gives authority. And you kind of were highlighting that aspect, Brenton. Legitimacy, and I say vitality, to the creative process and to little makers in general. Tolkien's subcreative vision invites us to see value in creativity for creativity's sake. Moreover, his vision gives us the freedom to make. And what I think needed to happen as part of this talk, but I maybe won't come out, is courage. Sure. I look at courage, and it was one of the things I found very late in the process, but that part of this was like, I found a thesis within a thesis. Yeah. Courage, that Tolkien's vision expresses the courage to make. And so in those really difficult points of my thesis writing, I use the words of the poem to help draw out that creative courage that Tolkien, that the poet in the Mythopoeia poem is. I go through the blessed are verses, and the blessed are the timid hearts, blessed are the ark builders, the legend makers with their rhyme, those that are in a small and bare room, and upon a clumsy loom weave tissues gilded by the far off day. Well, Tolkien, in those sections, I look at how this courageous vision of a way to approach our creative tasks. And he invests it with courage, he invests it with hope and faith over our work and the value of our work, and to let that be its own kind of narrative.
I think you're right. I think I actually had those blessed are passages open on my screen. I was hoping you would reference them. I have them just highlighted on out of the poem. And actually, one of your, I think a friend of yours, Tim Friesen, says the appendix E of, and this is more about inspiration, the thing you said just before courage, sparked a love, the appendix E sparked a love of languages, which I express in part by singing classical music in French, English, German, Italian, Russian, and Welsh. And I've collaborated to set some of those songs to music. Yeah. So I'm going to invite, if there's any kind of last question, if there's the last thing that somebody wants to say, I have two sort of questions. One, I don't know how to address, but I want to at least float the question from Tim Fisher, because I think it's a pretty good question, which is, what about the medium and the message? Like, how do the different sub-creative vocations, sub-creative vocations, how are they sort of expressing that vocation differently just by nature of the vocation? And I don't know if you want to address that or if you want to let that float. I think it's a more of a good meditation question for us. Because I wouldn't know how to address dance or...
Who was the scholar that said the medium is the message?
Yeah, well, I think that's the... Well, that's another Canadian, Marshall McLuhan, right? And I think Timothy Fisher's addressing that.
That's a great question. I'm not sure how to address that, actually.
And I think that's okay. I think that's a good one for people that are coming with that sense of sub-creative vision to answer, well, what does that mean for me to be a little maker in this moment? I think that's okay. Kate asks, do you think consciousness of being a sub-creator brings with it a sense of responsibility to find the truth in the act?
That is a great question.
Yeah, and then of course, why do we always succumb to terrors or fears as we're trying to finish our theses?
Yeah, what I love about that question is when I look back, and I do cover this in my thesis, when I came to the term sub-creation, yes, it brought many joyful things in game design, but I definitely felt a sense of responsibility. I definitely felt it definitely elevated the pressure, actually. And that was my own reading of On Fairy Stories a little bit, worked in there. There was a change when it was conscious, a conscious application. It was unconscious before that, or unknown. I didn't even know about sub-creation before, but when I could put sub-creation and apply that label to describe my work, it brought a lot of interesting things. And maybe I could just find a small portion I could read.
Sure.
So pressure, but also some valuable things that conscious connection had for me. So I'll find that in just a sec. Okay. Know exactly where it is, so okay. I am right about there. Okay. Okay, I'm ready to go unless you wanted to say something there, Brenton.
No, you go ahead.
Tolkien's subcreative vision renewed and extended my sight. Just as Tolkien demonstrated a preference in some of his letters for the word subcreative over creative, or subcreation over creation, I found particular value in using Tolkien's term itself to describe myself and my work. By calling my game design work subcreation and identifying personally as a subcreator or little maker, so this is conscious now, it effected a change in my perception of the creative work I was already doing. My vision was being enlarged by Tolkien's insight into the significance of our subcreative activity. The mere calling of my work subcreation provided me occasion to view my work as a provision of God, its process and product as a tribute to the infinity of his potential variety. And that comes from Tolkien's quote in the letters. Subcreation provided for me a framework wherein I could connect my creative activity to its origo. Its origin, further energizing my work while allowing me to acknowledge its source. Tolkien's subcreative vision helps us remember God, restoring a truth of the universe such that, as Milton puts it, man may know he dwells not in his own. So it took something that was much more natural and not very conscious, just my love of game design, and I'd been doing it for years. And so when I consciously applied the label, it definitely brought out a desire for excellence, but a vocational connection that this is a precious thing, a precious love that I have. It's valuable for its own sake. I need to press in, but there was more basis for it. It's more kind of teleological value in purpose in it, because I saw a connection to the source, the oracle. That element of worship came out as well. Yeah.
You know, I think that's brilliant. And I think that's probably a great space to end. I do want to, just because a couple of thoughts I'd love to float for the group that have come out of your thing that are here. And we just got another one, so I'll have to read that as we go. But Lyndon says, I love the medium and the message and how it connects to your work, because medium is equated to accessibility to various groups of people. And it begs the question, who has access to what is created? Mm-hmm. And I mean, with Tolkien, that's a huge question. But I think, would you just, as I'm just getting the next comment, just share super briefly about what you've done with your students and your game design, right? How you open access for your students there. Yeah.
Yeah. When I think of my students in game design, so they were my play testers. This is where the co-sub creative connection actually was the biggest. The process of hearing feedback from players, and my students intimately were had ideas, and because it was my company, I could bring some of those ideas to life in my own work. I don't know if I'm really addressing the question, though.
No, it was just, I think you had said once that a student wrote a module out of your world, the friend or foe world, I think, a student actually.
Yeah. There was a student that built within that world, yeah.
That's right. So there's a whole, like, you're actually sort of creating a world that then other people can use mm-hmm. in that kind of sense. So that's your particular medium. David Hepting says, have you ever found that it like sort of takes over, that subcreation develops a mind of its own, that it takes a different direction than you expected or wished it would take? Certainly with a thesis, right? That's happened for you.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah.
Yes, for sure. With game design as well. Lots of different ways I could answer that too. The friend or foe game that I made, I have those other, I wouldn't remember all of them in their total consistency, but I have 30 other versions in my head and those previous iterations. And many of those have the physical kind of expression of those too. I probably have 8 or so different printings of it, but many of those iterations just had little pieces. And so the final product is not the vision I had for Friend or Foe. But I was affected by the money aspect of it and the having to move to reuse artwork to make cards common, have common artwork where they were individual cards, they had different concepts, and I had to just delete concepts because of the cost involved in acquiring art. Yeah, so that's just one angle.
Yeah. Excellent. Yeah. Well, I think we should, we're at the top of the hour. I think we should close this off. I would encourage students to definitely, I guess the paper's in our library, but you can contact Rob if you wanted to see a bit more of it. It's certainly, one thing that strikes me is that the Signum students continue to be producing not just good thesis projects, because these are a bit unusual. We're driving you to a long version of what we would want you to submit for a journal, right? A real academic journal of some kind. But they're eminently readable. This is the thing that I'm loving about these Signum theses, and I hope that people will take a chance to read this. I was going to have you read the Blessed Rs, but you threw them out. You took the Beatitude, the doxology. But do you have it in front of you just to read to from the Timid Hearts?
I do. I had in that in mind, or how I end the thesis in mind.
So, oh yeah, do the latter. Go ahead. Yeah, that's fine. Yeah. And then we'll sign off from there. Go ahead.
Thank you again, all of those attending. just know that this is an ongoing conversation that I would love to have with you. Okay. So this is how I end the paper, but I think it sends us off on a good note. In Tolkien's subcreative vision, he shows us all the little makers of the world and invites us to see ourselves among them. From the little ark builders to the legend makers, from the highly esteemed fantasy writers to the little nigglers. Moreover, he invites us to see the scope of these creative contributions we add as our making extends into all the crannies of the world and beyond, even unto the eschaton, where in paradise we still will make, not being dead. The word subcreation gives expression to our creativity as gift. It provides a framework through which to examine and better understand human artistry and humankind itself. My personal journey with the word helped me to see the subcreative vision Tolkien had unfolded through his subcreation texts. I saw my ability to subcreate as my right, used or misused, and my creative work as having intrinsic value and worth on its own grounds. Tolkien's vision energizes and gives us the courage to make. Moreover, his vision invites us to hope in a good end for all our creative bents and faculties. My own story of subcreation allowed me to perceive the value in adopting Tolkien's word to describe our artistic efforts. Mm-hmm. Other words are available to describe our work, but subcreation is a term wherein Tolkien has embedded the desires, the challenges, and the joys associated with the things we make. Subcreation is an expansive word whose worth increases with its wear. Mm-hmm. And so I encourage us to wear it.
Good stuff. Right on. Excellent. All right. Well, thank you, everybody. As always, check out work on Facebook and the Signum site and take a look at catalog offerings coming up this summer. And I think you're trying to get to the spring conference, to the Moot in the spring. Is that right?
Yeah, you bet.
So you'll be able to go and get your signed copy of the thesis. Or all right. We'll see everyone. Good job, Rob. And have a great night.
Thank you. Have a great night.
Thanks.